powerful friend I would have been, but a much more powerful enemy I am now. So far, only my father's protection has saved you. That will change. No man stands in my way, I swear that to you." He wheeled his horse, put spurs to it, and galloped away. The other two disconsolate hunters trailed away after him. Mark rode back to Pungushi, and they drank from the water bottle and smoked a little before Mark asked, "Where is the lioness?" "We left her spoor 2 hours back." Mark glanced sharply at him, and Pungushi stood up and walked to another mole heap at the edge of the granite. He squatted beside it, and with a roll of his open palm outlined the fleshy pad of a lion paw. Then he bunched his knuckles and rolled them for the toe marks. Miraculously, the spoor of a full-grown lion appeared in the soft earth, and Pungushi looked up at Mark's startled, unbelieving expression and let out one of those whistling hippo snorts of laughter, rocking back on his heels delightedly.
"For 2 hours, we followed the Tokolosh," he hooted.
"I cannot see her," said Mark, carefully glassing the shallow wooded valley below them.
"How? Jamela, who cannot see?"
"Where is she, Pungushi?"
"Do you see the forked tree beyond the three round rocks?"
A step at a time he directed Mark's gaze, until suddenly he made out just the two dark round blobs of her ears above the short yellow grass, about 600 yards from where they sat. She was lying close in under the spread of a thorn thicket, and even as he watched, she lowered her head and the ears vanished.
"Now that she is alone, she wishes to return to the place she knows well, beyond the Usutu. That is why she moves always that way, when the pain of the wound allows."
Before they had come up with her, they had found three places where she had lain to rest, and at one such place there had been a smear of blood and a dozen yellow hairs glued into the clot. Pungushi had inspected the hairs minutely. By colour and texture he could tell from which part of the lioness body they had come.
"High in the right shoulder, and if she was bleeding inside she would be down already. But she is in great pain, for she walks short. The wound has stiffened. She cannot go far."
Now Mark swung the glasses towards the west, and longingly stared through them at the blue misty loom of the cliffs of Charka's Gate, half a dozen miles away.
"So close," he murmured, "so close."
But the exhausted cat was dragging herself painfully away from sanctuary, back towards the ploughed lands, towards cattle and men, and the dog packs. Instinctively he turned in that direction now, swinging the binoculars in a long, slow traverse across the north and east. From the low ridge he had a good field of sight across miles of light forest to the open chocolate expanse of ploughed land. Something moved in the field of the binoculars, and he blinked his eyes and refocused carefully. Three horsemen were coming slowly in their direction, and even at this range Mark could see the dogs running ahead of them. Quickly he looked back at the leading rider. There was no mistaking that arrogantly erect figure. Dirk Courtney had not given up the hunt. He had merely returned to assemble a hunting pack, and now the dogs were coming down fast on the smell of the wounded cat. Mark laid a hand on the hard muscle of Pungushi's shoulder, and with his free hand he pointed. The Zulu stood up and stared for a full minute at the oncoming horseman, and then he began to speak quickly.
"Jamela, I will try to call the lioness and lead her."
Mark started to ask a question, but Pungushi stopped him harshly.
"Can you pull the dogs away or stop them?"
Mark thought for a moment and then nodded. "Give me your snuff, Pungushi." He took the snuff horn that hung on a thong around his neck and handed it to Mark without question. "Go," said Mark. "Call my lioness for me." Pungushi slipped away down the ridge and left Mark to hurry to Trojan. There were three sticks of black dried meat left in Mark's food bag. He found two flat stones and pounded the dry meat into a fine powder between them, glancing up every few seconds to see the huntsman coming on rapidly. Once the meat was powdered, he scooped it into his pannikin and added an ounce of native snuff from the horn, mixing the two powders with his fingers as he ran back down the ridge to intersect the lioness trail at the point they had left it. When he reached the shoulder of the ridge, where the wounded cat had skirted a rocky outcrop, he knelt and made three neat piles of the mixed powder directly in the path of the oncoming dogs. The dried meat would be irresistible when they reached it. The dogs would sniff at it greedily. He could hear them already, baying excitedly, coming on swiftly, leading the hunters at a canter. As he ran back up the ridge to where Trojan stood, Mark smiled bleakly. A hound with a good suck of fiery native snuff up his nose wasn't going to smell anything else for at least 12 hours. The lioness lay on her side, with her mouth open. She panted for air, and her chest pumped like a blacksmith's bellows, and her eyes were tightly closed. The bullet had been fired from her right quarter. It was a soft lead slug from a .455 Martini Henry, and it had taken her high in the shoulder, but far forward, cutting in through the heavy muscle and grazing the big joint of the shoulder, lacerating sinew and shattering that extraordinary small floating bone found only in the shoulder of a lion, the lucky bone so prized as a hunter's talisman. The bullet had missed the artery as it plunged into the neck and lodged there beneath the skin, a lump the size of the top joint of a man's thumb. The flies swarmed joyously into the mouth of the wound, and she lifted her head and snapped at them, and then, mewing softly at the agony that movement had caused, she began to lick the bullet hole carefully, the long tongue rasping roughly against her hide, curling pink and dexterous, as it cleansed the fresh little trickle of watery blood that had sprung from it. Then she sank back wearily and closed her eyes again. Pungushi was aware of the wind in the same way as the helmsman of a tall ship is, for it was as important to him as it is to a mariner. He knew exactly at each moment of the day its force and direction, anticipated any change before it occurred, and did not have to carry an ash bag nor wet a finger. The knowledge was instinctive. Now he moved carefully into a downwind position from the wounded animal. It did not occur to him to thank any providence for the constant easterly breeze that put him fairly between the cat and the near boundary of Charka's Gate. Silent as the cloud shadow moves across the earth, he moved in on the cat, judging the extreme limit of her acute hearing before kneeling, facing where she lay, 300 yards away. He filled and deflated his lungs rapidly a dozen times, the great muscled chest swelling and subsiding as he built up reserves of oxygen in his blood. Then he caught a full breath and stretched out his neck at a peculiar angle, cupping his hands to his gaping mouth to act as a sounding board. From the depths of the straining chest issued a low drumming rattle that rose and sank to a natural rhythm and ended with an abrupt little cough. The lioness' head came up in a single flash of movement, her ears erect, her eyes alight with yellow lights, for in her pain and fear and confusion she had heard the old Tom calling to her, that low, far-carrying assembly call with which he had directed her hunting so often, and which he had used to bring her to him when separated in thick bush. The pain of rising was almost too much for her. The wound had stiffened, and her neck and shoulder and chest were crushed under a granite boulder of agony. But at that moment she heard for the first time the distant yelping chorus of the dog pack. She and the old Tom had been hunted by dogs before, and the sound gave her strength. She came up and stood for a moment on three legs, favouring the right fore, panting heavily. And then she went forward, whining softly at the pain, carrying the bad leg high, lunging for balance at each stride. Mark watched from the ridge, saw the yellow cat start to move again, hobbling slowly westwards at last. Far ahead of her, keeping out of sight, the big Zulu trotted, pausing whenever she faltered to kneel and repeat the assembly call of a dominant male lion, and each time the lioness answered him with eager little mewling grunts and hobbled after him, westward, towards the dreaming blue hills that guarded the Bubezi Valley. Mark had heard the old hunter's stories before. Old man Anders had always claimed that his gun-bearer, who had been killed by an elephant on the Sabi River in 84, could call lions. However, Mark had never seen it done, and secretly had put the story into the category of the picturesque but apocryphal. Now he saw it happening, and still wanted to doubt it. He watched, fascinated, from his grandstand upon the ridge, and only a change in the clamour of the dog pack made him swing his binoculars back towards the east. At the rocky shoulder of the ridge where he had set his bait of powdered biltong and snuff, the pack milled confusedly. There were 8 or 9 dogs, a mongrel pack of terriers and boarhounds and ridgebacks. The determined hunting chorus had disintegrated into a cacophony of whines and yelps, while Dirk Courtney overrode them, standing in his stirrups to lay about them furiously with the horsewhip. Mark took Trojan's reins and led him down off the ridge, using what little cover there was, but confident that the huntsmen were too involved with their own problems to look ahead and see him. When he reached the place beside the thorn thicket where the lioness had last lain, he cut a branch with his clasp knife and used it like a broom to brush away any sign the cat had left. He followed slowly westwards towards Charker's gate, pausing every few minutes to listen for the drumming lion call, watching the ground as he moved, and using the branch to brush away all lion sign, covering for his lioness, until in the dusk they climbed a low saddle through the hills, and in slow, drawn-out procession went down to the Bubezi River. Pungushi made his last call in darkness, and then ran out in a wide circle, leaving the lioness within 100 yards of the river, knowing how she'd be burned up by the heat of the wound, and crazed for water. He found Mark by the glow of his cigarette. "Get up," said Mark, and gave him an arm. Pungushi did not argue. He had run almost without a pause since before dawn, and he swung up behind Mark. They rode home, 2 up on Trojan's broad sway back, and neither of them spoke until they saw the lantern light in the cottage window. "Jamela," said Pungushi, "I feel the way I did the day my first son was born." And there was a tone of wonder in his voice. "I did not believe a man could feel thus for a devil that kills cattle and men." Lying in the darkness, with Marion beside him in the double bed, Mark told her about it, trying to convey the wonder and the sense of achievement. He told her what Pungushi had said, and stumbled for words to describe his own feelings, to come haltingly at last into silence.
"That's very nice, dear. When are you going to town again? I want to buy some curtains for the kitchen. I thought a checked gingham would look pretty. What do you think, dear?"
The lioness gave birth to her cubs in the thick jesse bushes that choked one of the narrow tributary valleys which came down off the escarpment. There were 6 cubs, but they were almost 3 weeks old when Mark first saw them. He and Pungushi lay belly down on the edge of the cliff that overlooked the valley when she led them back from the river in the dawn. The cubs followed her in an untidy straggle spread over 100 yards. The sinew in her right fore had healed, crooked and slightly shorter, which gave her a heaviness in her gait, a roll like a sailor's, as she came up the draw. One of the cubs, more persistent than the rest, was trying to suckle from her pendulant, heavy, multiple dugs as she walked. He kept making clumsy, flying leaps at them as they swung above his head. Mostly he fell on his head and got trodden on by his mother's back feet, but once he succeeded and hung like a fat brown tick on one nipple. The lioness whirled about and cuffed him left and right, then began to lick him with a tongue that wrapped around his head entirely, and knocked him on his back again. One of the other cubs was stalking his siblings, crouching in ambush behind a single blade of grass, with flattened ears and viciously slitted eyes. When he leapt out on his brothers and sisters, and they totally ignored his warlike manoeuvres, he covered his embarrassment by turning back and sniffing the grass blade with such attention that it seemed this had been his original intention. 3 of the others were hunting butterflies. There had been a new hatching of Colotus ioni. On white and purple wings they fluttered close to the earth, and the cubs reared on their hind legs and boxed at them with more gusto than skill, overbalancing at the end of each attack and collapsing in a fluffy tangle of outsized paws. The 6th cub was hunting the tails of the butterfly hunters. Every time they slashed their little tufted tails in the feverish excitement of the chase, he pounced upon them with savage growls, and they were forced to turn and defend themselves against the sting of his needle-sharp baby teeth.